Good evening and welcome to Monsters Among Us. I am your camp counselor, Derek Hayes. Welcome to Camp MAU, everyone. And boy, do I have something sinister lined up for you this evening. With the 4th of July in our rearview mirror, we've set course for the spooky season. A summerween, if you will. And to celebrate this summerween, pack your sleeping bag, your hiking shoes, and your sunscreen, because we're headed back to camp. Now, I don't know what it is about summer camps, but they're synonymous with horror and the paranormal. Maybe it's the array of 80s horror films set at various camps, films that, for better or worse, shaped my youth. Or maybe it's the idea of being alone, away from family for possibly the first time. Or perhaps all the legends these places seem to collect over the years. Tales of haunted bunkhouses, lake legends, psycho killers on the loose, and so much more. And we'll also visit a few other summer pastimes that tend to put people in peril out in nature. But overall, it's that sort of story that we're after here tonight. A collection of summertime outdoor scares, just in time for summerween. So crack a cold one, toss some more wood on the bonfire, and unfold a lawn chair. It's summerween, and I have some stories to share with you. Beginning with this call, the origin is unknown, but it takes place in the state of Georgia. Kat, welcome to tonight's special presentation.
Hi, this is Kat. I'm currently listening to Season 3, Episode 7, and Gary's story just finished, and it reminded me of something that happened when I was a teenager. When I was about 11, 12 years old, the church that I was with was doing a practice run on camping outdoors. So 15 girls in an army tent on 80 acres of property on someone's farm. This happened near Pine Mountain, Georgia, in just the beginning of summer. Clear night, beautiful night. I was with my older sister. She's 14 years old at the time, and we were asleep. It was about 10, 11 o'clock at night, and the outside wall of the army tent had like those fake windows that don't have any coverings on them. I heard footsteps, snuffling, like a dog just really concentrating on one spot to sniff. I climbed out of my sleeping bag because one of the counselors was sitting up at the picnic bench at the front flap of the army tent. So I quietly got up on all fours and I looked out of the little fake window, and what I saw terrified me, but I wasn't sure if it was threatening or not, because there were two dogs, small little terrier and a lab, but with them was this 2 to 3 foot tall, looked like a skinned dog from Resident Evil, but fawn colored, fleshy, just sitting there with those two dogs. Like, the dogs were used to it. I don't know if it was a deformed dog or what have you, but I dropped down to my belly, started crying, and literally crawled inside my sister's sleeping bag with her until the sun came up. I'm not sure what it was. It could have been a skinned dog without ears. But I heard Gary's story and the way he described it, walking towards him out of the woods, just put me back in that memory of when I was 11 years old in the dark with just a tent flap between me and this thing. All I remember was I was just terrified. I'd really love to hear your opinion or anyone else's opinion, but I just wanted to share because that memory came up because of Gary's story. But thank you so much. Love the podcast. Bye.
Thank you, Kat. Now, of course, my immediate thought is that of the Texas Chupacabra, said to be canine in shape, but skinnier, with shorter front legs than back, and most notably its skin, a hairless blue or gray leather-like texture. So I suppose sort of like the dogs from Resident Evil that Kat referenced. I've linked to an image of those creatures if you're not familiar. But as alien as these Texas Chupacabras look, it's widely believed that what folks are seeing down there are just dogs, raccoons, foxes, or coyotes, with a condition known as mange. And those that don't recall from past episodes, here's a quick refresher on that nasty skin disorder.
One disease that affects wild animals is called mange.
Mange is actually a mite. It's a little organism that gets on the skin of the animals.
In Texas, it's known to affect coyotes, foxes, even domestic dogs. Mange affects a canine's appearance.
And it causes severe itching, and that will lead to them scratching and licking and chewing at their skin, causing the skin to become inflamed and pigmented and thickened and severe hair loss.
Now that's a clip from the Monster Quest episode on the Chupacabra. But there are a few issues here. Some of these animals don't seem to fit the model of a simple mange case. The body shape is morphed, it's different. Like I'd mentioned, it has longer back legs. And it also has a longer snout, longer fangs, and bright blue eyes. None of those attributes are side effects of mange or any other skin disorder that I know of. Also, there is this one detail, which also comes to us from that same Monster Quest episode.
But not everyone agrees with the mange theory.
I've killed mangy coyotes before, and most of them that you kill, they either have hair somewhere on them under their belly or on the back of them have hair. But this here had no hair hardly at all on him.
I don't know. Dude's got a point. Now, I don't think I'll solve the Chupacabra mystery tonight, nor do I intend to. But it's important to compare other similar legends. And it's also important to explore different hypotheses, different theories as to what this animal could have been. And in doing so, I am reminded of a campfire story I remember from my childhood, one that just might present a plausible explanation. The story was told to me by my cousin from the Salt Lake, Utah area. He and his family were visiting my grandparents, and him being a few years older and having just returned from summer camp himself, had all sorts of these campfire ghost stories. And there's one in particular that I can recall that reminds me of Kat's story, and it went something like this. Out west here somewhere, the Colorado, Utah, Wyoming area, there's this tiny little mountain community, a few thousand year-round residents, a lake with a little island, a place that you'd only want to visit certain times of the year. Otherwise, you'll get snowed in or something. And this place was just recovering from a large forest fire that had passed through the area just 1 year prior. So the town was even more empty than usual, given the summer months. Well, word began to spread around town that a large, bipedal, hairless beast was roaming the area, knocking over trash cans, tipping dumpsters, and even raiding chicken coops and pig pens. In a span of 6 months, there was hardly a resident that hadn't had a run-in with this awful, unidentified creature. Well, as time passed, the carnage grew, and the only evidence of this mysterious monster came in the form of a set of bipedal, strangely shaped footprints, and a rare glimpse here and there of a gray, hairless beast shuffling off into the darkness. Eventually, a tracker was brought in to kill the beast that had staked claim to the area. A creature said to stand 8 foot tall if it stood an inch. Well, after some time, the tracker chased the animal into the lake and pursued it all the way to that little island somewhere in the middle, where he finally took it down with a single bullet from his rifle. As he approached the twisted and deformed animal that lay in a heap at his feet, he began to realize exactly what it was he had just shot. It was a creature that had survived the recent forest fire, though from the looks of things, just barely. Its feet mangled and deformed, its skin tight and twisted, its ears burned from its skull. The animal was once a large black bear, but its current appearance reflects the aftermath of its brush with a fiery death. The animal had resorted to easy meals in town as a result of its injuries, which meant pets and livestock. Now, that story scared the living hell out of me as a child. A child that lived deep in the southeast Ohio woods. The only thing I could think of that was worse than a bear attack is a bear attack from a deformed and desperate animal. And even as a child, that's a fact that I knew. Which brings me to my connection here. Kat had mentioned that the animal she saw was earless, an extremity often lost by fire victims. Perhaps the creature she saw suffered the same as the bear did in my cousin's story. Maybe it was a normal dog with an abnormal appearance. And if so, it's mighty nice of those other two dogs to stick around and help it out. But that's assuming that any of this was explainable at all. Because if we know anything about the great outdoors, Kat, it's that out there, anything seems possible. So thank you again, Kat, for proving that narrative true.
I don't really believe you have...
And in Silmar, 5 North...
Obviously was in and out...
And 0% financing up to 100...
Now, folks, our next entry details a run-in with one of the notorious Shadow Men, Cameron. Welcome to the Summerween special episode.
Hi, my name is Cameron, and I would just like to call in about an incident I had at summer camp. I'm 13 years old, and I live in Northeast Ohio, and let's just keep it short and get to the story. So I went to summer camp this past summer, and it was free time at summer camp, and I went to the cabin where we were staying, and me and my friend Jaden and Avery were there, and we didn't want to do free time, so we just stayed in the cabin. So we got on top of one of the bunks, and we were just telling scary stories, and then we didn't really know what to say. We're like, we don't really have any scary stories. What are we going to do now? And then, like, 30 seconds after we were thinking of scary stories, we heard this huge bang in the corner of the cabin. So we looked over, and there was nothing there. And we were like, what the heck was that? And, like, we were speechless for, like, 3 minutes. And they made me get down and get a flashlight. So I did, and I ran over and got a flashlight. And I pointed it straight to where the sound was. And it was coming from the bathroom. And, like, 15 minutes later, we were still in bed, just scared. And we went to the bathroom, and there was a Nerf gun, so we took the Nerf gun, which that's not really going to do anything, but we took the Nerf gun, and we went to the bathroom and we kicked the bathroom open. There was nothing in the bathroom. We checked everywhere. And then we went out of the bathroom and we saw this shadow man coming from the other room. So we ran over there as fast as I can. By we, I mean me, because I'm the bravest of the group. I ran over there and there was nothing there. So we turned on all the lights because we were freaked out. And then we left the cabin and like went up to the like lodge because we were so freaked out. And then we came back and all the lights were off, all of them. And then we searched around a little bit and we couldn't find anything. So we turned the lights off, closed the bathroom door, and left again. And then we came back and all the lights were off and the bathroom door was wide open. I can't explain it. It's just really creepy. And then we walked out and like right behind the cabin there's a bunch of woods. It's really creepy. And then we walked out to the cabin and then we decided let's go back again. So this time we turned all the lights on and closed all the doors. And when we were going back to the cabin, we saw another shadow man walk into where the cabin is. And that freaked us out. So we went in there and every door in the entire place was wide open and the lights were all off. And then we walked in there and we just were like, nah, we're leaving. And then we just ran to the lodge, just waited for everyone to come back. It was just creepy and I cannot understand what it was. I cannot explain it. It's still very creepy. So that's my story. And I love your podcast. I've been binge listening it. And peace.
Thank you, Cameron. You know, I went to summer camp in Ohio once. The same sixth grade camp I believe most American children go to. Outdoor education, I believe they called it at the time. No monsters for me, though. Although I may or may not have scared a few fellow children with a story or two. A precursor to my eventual career as a spook jockey, I suppose. So I get it, Cameron. Even the smallest amount of fear is elevated when shared with a group of like-minded and equally as freaked out people. Mass hysteria, some people call it. And that would be a tidy and neat explanation, if that's what actually happened to Cameron and his bunkmates. But based on the story, it could have gone either way. So of course, it could have been a sinister presence. Either way, we thank you, Cameron, for taking the time to share your experience. Now, folks, if you too have a story to share, a true paranormal story, give our hotline a call at 1-888-608-NIGHT. That's 888-608-NIGHT. You can also send me a voice memo at monstersamonguspodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to call from a quiet place. Finish your call if you start one, even if you have to call back in. And please, only one story per phone call, unless there's some sort of underlying connection, of course. But most importantly, keep those calls coming, folks. And don't forget, I'm always in search of more monster calls. So if you have one, let's hear it. Now, you know that feeling you get when you leave the house or go far away? The feeling that something bad might happen while you're gone. Well, imagine how you would feel if you went to summer camp in the 1980s, with no cell phone and no contact back home. Then, imagine something bad actually happening. That's where we find our next submitter, Christy, out of the Land of a Thousand Lakes.
Hi, this is Christy from Minnesota. I'm sitting here and remembered something that happened when I was a teenager. I was 14 or 15. I was in the Boundary Waters with Camp Widgiewagon, which is an amazing YMCA camp. And I know that the group started thinking that I was pretty strange because I cried a lot while we were on our trip in the Boundary Waters. And I couldn't explain why I was so sad. I couldn't explain it. I just kept saying, there is something wrong at home. I don't know what's wrong, but something is wrong at home. And I really just want to be home. Now I'm in the Boundary Waters. I'm 6 hours away from St. Paul, where I grew up. You can't just leave the Boundary Waters. So I finished the trip, went back into camp, got a letter from my baby sister, who was 4 years younger than me. And in the letter, she told me that my Uncle Ray, who was the closest thing to a grandfather that I had ever had, had passed while my other sister and I were at Wijewagen. And I thought, okay, that explains it. I loved Uncle Ray. He was an amazing man, taught me how to cane fish, kept me from falling off the little dam that we fished off of. Amazing man, fantastic guy. And as I said, closest thing to a grandfather I ever had. He was actually my grandfather's brother because my grandma and her sister married brothers. So I figured, okay, that's what it is. But I still had this heaviness and this almost dread hanging on me. So when we got back to the cities, to the Twin Cities, got picked up by our parents, we were told, my younger sister was a year younger than I, we were at the same time at this camp. And we were told that not only had our uncle died, but cousins who were 16 and 17, kind of wild child, had died in a drunk driving accident the weekend that I was in the Boundary Waters. It still shakes me to this day when I think about it, and I am nearing 60. I didn't know at the time. Found out later from my aunt, after some other things happened, that my dad's family is fair to middling psychic. We have dreams that frequently come true. We tend to know things are happening. We tend to get quote-unquote feelings that you can't define until shortly after. Sometimes we've been able to stop things from happening, but that's pretty rare. It's not a specific enough, usually, feeling to know exactly what's going to happen. But my husband has even gotten to the point where if I say, you know what, I really don't want to do that, I just have a bad feeling about it, we don't do whatever it is I have a bad feeling about. Thanks again for your stories and all the work y'all do. This is a wonderful podcast, and thanks again. Bye.
Thank you, Christy. That is a legitimate fear of mine, even with the conveniences of cell phones and FaceTime and security cameras. I still fear that I will leave my house for a few days and something bad will happen that I otherwise could have stopped. An intruder, a fire, some sort of catastrophic equipment failure. Maybe that's all normal. Or maybe I need to increase my BetterHelp appointments. But either way, it's a fear that I understand. But imagine something bad happening for real, like with Christine. Then imagine somehow knowing the trouble was brewing without actually knowing or being able to do anything about it. Which leads me to my last point. Having bad feelings. Now, I too have had feelings that were too strong to ignore. I try my best to act on those feelings when I have them, because it seems like the obvious move. And since nothing bad has happened as a result, I assume it all worked out for the best. But if I've learned anything in my years, it's that the hard part about having these feelings of dread and acting on them is not the acting part, but instead it's trying to convince other people to go along with a wild hunch. In your case, Christine, it doesn't seem like there was much you could have done to change things. But all these strange connections and or coincidences certainly make for an interesting story. And we thank you for sharing it here with us tonight.
2024.
Except for the new ones.
Engineers feel confident.
Old wives' tale that it takes one day.
Now this next entry puts us in a tent in the woods at night. For that, I send it over to this anonymous caller from Parts Unknown.
Hi there. I'll do my best to keep this recording short, but for this entry, I have a story that I think might interest you. Back when I was about 16, I went on a camping trip with my scout group up into, I think it was the Black Hills of Idaho in Wyoming. While we were there, being the rebellious child I was, I decided to take a challenge I had heard from the Navajo people that I had taken some classes from a few months earlier about whistling into the wind. They told me not to because it would bring the witches and skinwalkers of their culture to me. Since I didn't believe any of that stuff, I did. That night, while I was in my tent, I heard something wander around my tent a couple of times. It sounded very human. It was sitting there checking my tent out. But when I got up to check out who it was, I heard something run off on all fours. That left me pretty rattled, but I didn't think it was a skinwalker or whatever other legend I had heard. I thought it was just an animal. The next day, we were packing up to leave, and as we stopped at a gas station to pick up some snacks and gas, I look over to my right side and I see a large black dog with shining red eyes. Now, for people who don't know this, in a lot of the Western cultures, Native American cultures here in the United States, a black animal with red eyes symbolizes witchcraft. And I knew right then and there that was what had been around my tent the previous night. Hopefully one of you guys can use this. But yeah, love the show. Keep it going.
Thank you, caller. You know, speaking of stories that shook me when I was younger, I had a small collection of ghost story books as a kid, probably a direct result from the stories that my cousin had told us that one summer. And you know, in one of these books, The Scariest Stories You've Ever Heard Of, Part 2, by Catherine Burt, there was a story called It Walks at Midnight. And it, too, was about a group of backpackers that were camping in Red River Gorge, wherever that is. And while at camp, their little dog darted into the bushes and soon ran back in fear, as a large, beastly, black dog with coal red eyes floated from the underbrush above the dog and the two hikers. The spectral hound even seemed to motion to them before it drifted off with a mournful howl. The next day, the two men met with rangers, and that's when they learned that they weren't the only ones to see the ghostly animal. Reports of a spectral dog have been collected in that area for nearly 50 years. And further research led them to a missing child report from 1935, in which a 10-year-old boy disappeared from his family's camp one rainy night, as did the boy's large black lab, Midnight. A month or so passes, and the hikers meet up with the ranger to return to the spot of the encounter in hopes to see the ethereal hound once again. After several twists and turns through the Appalachian outback, the scary black dog with the red eyes appeared, and it led them to a pile of bones at the bottom of a cliff. Among the bones was a child's skull, a dog skull, and a rotted leather collar. They tagged it red. Midnight. So you see, caller, although typically we're accustomed to painting pooches like this as hellhounds or evil dogs that do the devil's bidding, but just know that there are some stories out there in which this mysterious black canine is not a creature of evil, and instead acts as a guardian in some way. So if you see one of these spectral hounds, keep your distance and be cautious, but don't be afraid to think that it might be something positive you're seeing instead. Thank you again, caller, for ringing in. Oh, and I've posted the story in full in the show notes if you'd like to read along.
The killings of two
families home.
Now, I still have a lot of these Summerwing calls to get through, so let's jump back into the action with Jake's call from Oregon.
So this is Jake out of Oregon, and I would meet up with my friends once a year, end of September, for a week that would go to the through the 1st of October out at Lake Pillsbury in Northern California. I mean, if you've been out there, you know that the only way to really get out there is to, you know, once you get off the main roads, you take a dirt road for, I don't know, 7-8 miles. And at that time of year, the reason why we'd go is because the campsites were closed. So end of season, you know, there wasn't going to be a whole lot of people there, but it was still warm enough and not raining. So we could, you know, kind of have run of the place. There was one campsite that stayed open through the off season, Oak Flats. We would go there. And we were the only ones there this year. This was maybe 2014. And the, I want to say, third night, we're there. Everyone, you know, there's maybe 10 of us in our tents and trying to get some sleep outside of my tent. And I was the only one in there. I heard some footsteps. And, you know, I hear like critters in the bush. They make a certain kind of noise. This was clearly two. So I called out, you know, to my friends. I was like, hey, is that you? Or, you know, gotta take a leak, you know, get out of the tent, whatever. No answer. Footsteps stopped. So I'm real quiet. It's right outside my tent. It's right next to my tent. So the only thing between us is, you know, my tent wall, which is super thin. And all of our tents, too, in the camp were pretty close, you know, within 10, 15 feet of each other. And no one answered. So I figured everyone else was asleep. Okay, maybe this is an animal. Heard some more footsteps kind of get closer and go around my tent a little bit. You know, I wasn't going to be out there without protection, so I had a 30-30 rifle loaded with safety on and grabbed it and called out again, like, hey, who's out there? No answer. And footsteps stopped. Opened up my tent and grab my flashlight, take a look out, and yeah, nothing. There was nothing there. There was no animals in the bush. There was nothing behind the tree that I had tethered to. Yeah, I clearly heard footsteps. Two, you know, like bipedal type footsteps and heavy. There was, it sounded like a person, but there was nothing. There was nothing there. Just really weird. Yeah, thought I might share that, you know. Never experienced anything like that before or since. But being the only ones out there was definitely creepy. All right. Love your show. Thanks again.
Thank you, Jake. Another tent mystery. You know, after hearing all these stories about strangeness outside people's tents, I'm starting to think a little viewport on these things might be a good idea. Sort of like a peephole on a door. Nothing Velcroed or zippered. You don't want to make any noise. But just a little section of clear plastic that allows you to see the bipedal beast breathing down upon you. I wonder, though, if such a thing should exist, how many of you would be brave enough to take a look? Now, I took some rookies camping once, and they fed their dog next to my tent, unbeknownst to me. A few hours later, I awoke to a coyote literally crunching spilled dog food, not 1 foot from my sleeping head. Talk about a sound that will jolt you awake. So I could only imagine the psychological torture of a set of bipedal footsteps outside your thin nylon walls. Better you than me, Jake. But thank you so much for sharing the entry. Now, folks, don't forget to visit our little shop for all of your MAU merchandise needs. Get yourself a hat, a shirt, a tote, a bag, a poster, pins, stickers, and much more by visiting monstersamonguspodcast.com and by clicking on the shop tab. All sales go directly back to the show, and your support is immensely appreciated. Now, back to the action with this folklore out of Canada. Jay, welcome to the airwaves.
Hi, it's Jay from Southern Alberta. I was listening to your season 16, episode 12, and I heard some Goatman stories, and it reminded me of this from my childhood. Little backstory on me, I was born and raised into a old-fashioned Christian home. I kind of grew up to be the black sheep, but that's neither here nor there. But my parents sent me to a Bible camp in the summer. I want to say I was 10 or 11. I believe it was my first year I'd went to this specific one. And where it's located, there's little cabins down at the bottom of the hill where the campers and the counselors all sleep. There's probably like 6 bunk beds and then a single bed for the counselor in each cabin. And then up the hill, there's the big like camp kitchen type place where everybody gathers and does all the worship stuff and whatnot. And that night we'd been up at the camp kitchen and they were telling stories. And they were telling a story about the goat man and how he lives in this creepy little shed that's probably like 500 meters to the one direction of this camp. There's just this one creepy, lonely little shed off in this field about 500 meters, and they were saying the goat man lived there. And it kind of spooked me because I was still young, and after that we all went down to the cabins and went to bed. And this was before I had a phone or an iPod or anything like that, so I'm not sure of the time, but I woke up at some random point in the night, and everybody was sleeping, including the counselors, all the other kids. Everyone was sleeping soundly. And I wake up out of nowhere, and I see this figure with, I don't want to say a goat's head, but that's honestly what it looked like. It looked like he had the horns on the top of his head and everything. He had goat's legs, like a goat's bottom end, but a human torso. And he was just kind of staring down at the kid on the bottom bunk that was next to me. Like, my bunk was next to this kid, and I was up on the top bunk of this bunk that was next to this kid. And this figure was just staring at him. He was probably like 5.5 feet tall, maybe 5 feet tall, I'm not too sure. I was higher than it up on my bunk. And then once I had woken up, I stayed silent, but it just looked straight up from where it was looking, not quite at the kid on the top bunk. And then it just turned and started like just almost marching, but quietly out of the cabin. And then he quietly opened the door and walked out and quietly shut it, and he was gone. I don't know if what I saw, if I dreamt it or what, but it seemed far too vivid and it stuck with me this long. I mean, I was 10 then and I'm in my mid-20s now. So, I don't know. It was an odd occurrence. I'm not too sure. Love to hear your opinion. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Jay. All sorts of Goatman stories across the country. And it's kind of wild that they all exist out there, but Also kind of scary to know that there are that many out there that I haven't even heard of. But what I love about this call is the legend surrounding the camp. I just love that it exists. Again, maybe it's 80s nostalgia, but there is just something about summer camps that sets the mood perfectly. It's the ideal breeding ground for legends and lore, and maybe even a true cautionary tale from time to time. Now, before we move on to the next entry, I thought it would be fun to explore a few other well-known summer camp legends from across the country. So I asked Delaney to gather up a short list, and she certainly didn't disappoint. For example, Paul the Acid Man from Camp Voyager in Minnesota. Paul was a mild-mannered, even nerdy camp attendee in the 1980s. He was known around camp as a bit of a rock hound and always carried a bit of hydrochloric acid with him to test rocks that he found. But one day, some bullies in camp were playing keep away with the bottle when it broke, splashing Paul in the face with the acid. He ran screaming into the woods, never to be seen again. Except that over the next 20 years, food would come up missing, and even a canoe at a certain point. Then eventually the odd camper would go missing from time to time, which leads some people to say that he's still out there, his face a mangled mess, and his mind set on revenge. Then you have Stumpy from the Luthi Peterson camp of New Hampshire. Is said to be haunted by a former homesteader from the area that accidentally severed his own arm with an axe while chopping away some ice over the winter. He was all alone, and with no one answering his pleas for help, he bled to death there on the ice. Now, over the years, town folks, farmers, and hunters alike report regular sightings of a one-armed man carrying an axe. Legend says that old Stumpy is still out there, taking limbs and lives on dark, quiet nights at the Luthi Peterson summer camp. Then you have Seaweed Sally from Camp Big Silver in Michigan. Sally was a local girl who drowned while canoeing in the camp's lake. Sally had a fear of water, and instead of helping her, her peers led her to the middle of the lake and tipped the canoe she was in. Sadly, Sally sank into the depths immediately and was never seen again. Locals in the community presumed Sally had drowned, but even after they drained the lake, her remains were never found. Now, boys at Camp Big Silver are warned to be careful of Seaweed Sally, as she's been known to grasp ankles of swimmers and pull them down to their watery graves. And some campers that are staying in cabins down by the lake have even reported seaweed hanging from their bunks and watery footprints leading outside their doors. And those are just a few of the distinctive and specific tales that persist at these little camps across the U.S., each distinctly spooky in their own different way. Sounds like the perfect subject for a book if one would be so inclined. Maybe that author is you. Either way, thank you again, Jay, for the tale. You can't go wrong with a good Goatman legend. Now, you can't have a Summerween special episode without a story about Sasquatch. So here to meet our quota is Traveler from the state of Utah.
Hey, Derek. This is Traveler from Utah. I really enjoy the podcast, and I thought, since I've been listening for a while, I'd call in and tell my own spooky story about a Bigfoot encounter I had in Montana. So back in, I'd say, maybe 2017, maybe 2018, I was in Montana hanging out with some friends up in Butte or Kalispell. And we were out in the woods, and me and my friends, we had this little campsite out there with like a treehouse and stuff. So we were out there one night. We're all sitting around the campfire just telling stories and stuff. And all of a sudden, I just hear this noise just off in the distance, just like this big oh, it's this growl or roar or whatever. We all just go quiet and look around. We're like, what was that? And then, I kid you not, a rock came flying at us the size of a Super Duty tire, came flying out of the woods and landed in the fire, and fire just went everywhere. And then we put out the fire and we all ran inside the cabin of the treehouse. And all throughout the night, we just heard banging on the walls and roaring and scratching. And when we came out the next morning, there was rocks everywhere, trees everywhere, and the cabin was just tore up. So, yeah, thank you for letting me share my story. Love the podcast. Bye.
Thank you, Traveler. What an experience. Now, I have a whole lot I want to cover surrounding this encounter and very little time to do it. So listen up and hold on. Firstly, with the attack on the little cabin that Traveler and his friends were staying in, it reminds me a lot of an infamous Sasquatch event that took place 100 years ago this summer, an event now known simply as the attack at Ape Canyon. A run-in with upright, hairy hominids that were anything but the gentle giants that you sometimes see on the television. Here is a lengthy but succinct version of the story via a show I enjoy watching, History's Expedition X.
1924, gold prospectors flock to the slopes of Mount St. Helens, hoping to strike it rich. But a few of them encounter something else, hidden in the volcano's thick forest. According to reports, five men find a promising spot along a treacherous slope, where they build a cabin and establish a small gold mining operation. But one day, they claim to spot a frightening figure across the canyon, standing at nearly 7 feet tall with blackish brown hair. The men shoot at the creature, but it disappears into the woods. The miners are so unnerved by what they see, they agree to abandon the cabin at first light. But in the dead of night, the cabin reportedly comes under siege, bombarded by rocks. The miners catch a glimpse of their attackers, which appear to be large, bipedal primates. The miners shoot in defense, but the assault rages on through the night. At first light, the five men flee the cabin. Back in town, their story becomes front page news, and the remote gorge where the incident allegedly took place becomes known as Ape Canyon.
Now, I'm sure you can see why I find parallels in these two stories. The attack on the cabin itself being the most prominent connection. But let's instead focus on another detail of the story, the rock-throwing aspect of the tale. Now, I cannot tell you how many stories I have heard about Sasquatch or Bigfoot throwing rocks or sticks at intruders. And it probably shows. I know I've talked about that characteristic a good bit here on the show. But I suppose it's for good reason, because throwing those objects is a known ape behavior. Gorillas, chimps, orangutans. They've all been reported to throw items, as would a human. Which I suppose makes the idea that Bigfoot is an undiscovered ape at least a potential possibility. Now, as a bit of an example of this behavior, here is a clip from the near 20-year-old television program, Monster Quest, that describes rock throwing at one of their research sites at Snellgrove Lake, up in Canada.
Without warning, a rock flies out of the woods and hits the cabin.
One of us was urinating off the porch.
About.
When the first stone hit the side of the cabin.
This rock on the side of the building was bang. That's scary.
Camera crews scan the immediate area with the night vision and thermal cameras as the team retreats into the cabin. One crew member threw a rock back into the woods, only to have another rock thrown back.
And that was followed shortly after by a rather larger rock bouncing down the roof of the cabin. This is quite distinct. Obviously, there's nothing in the woods that's recognized anyway that can lob rocks in that fashion.
And we're all together. I'm with everybody, so I know that it's nobody goofing around.
while one cameraman scouts around the area. The rest of the team lock themselves into the cabin for the night.
Now you heard it there, I bet. No other animal in North America should be able to throw a rock. Well, for the longest time, I thought that was true and accurate. But we recently discovered a news story that challenges that notion.
It was not the up-close and personal kind of experience that visitors at the Minnesota Zoo had in mind when they went there this morning, but a grizzly bear smashed the glass of its enclosure as stunned witnesses stood on and watched.
All of a sudden, while they were wrestling and playing, one of them picked up a very large rock. It had to weigh 50 pounds and did a chest pass with that rock, just like Wes Unseld used to do with the basketball, into the glass.
Now that clip on behalf of KMSP, Fox News 9, out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. And there you have it, folks. There are other animals out there that can throw rocks. But can they throw rocks with that sort of accuracy? Can they throw with that sort of distance? That is the big question here. And Traveler mentioned that the huge rock that was thrown at him landed directly on top of the fire, causing hot coals to shoot into the air. Well, that sort of direct hit requires some sort of accuracy. Accuracy I'm not sure that a bear possesses. And accuracy I doubt most humans would have with a rock that size. So where does that leave us? What else could be out there that could chuck a rock? I'm not so sure I want to find out. But I do want to thank you, Traveler, for reminding us to stay on our toes. You never know what's out there or what they may be capable of. Oh, and if you're curious as to what it looks like when Bigfoot throws something at you, I've linked to a video that claims to depict just that in tonight's show notes. A video filmed in the state of Utah, of all places. Visit monstersamonguspodcast.com and click the show notes tab, or hit up the description of this post.
And where the
frustration.
Needed because they.
Their A plus rating with special
way sharing their rendezvous.
Now, another summer pastime that might put you in potential danger is a simple one: hiking. Each year, well over 100 people disappear while doing a routine hike. And that's just here in the United States. So if you think you're safe out there, guess again. And if you don't believe me, take Cassie's word for it.
Hey, Derek. My name is Cassie. I'm calling from Colorado, but in regards to Southern California, Altadena, actually. I was just listening to Season 6, Episode 13. And Stephen was talking about the Altadena Forest. And mine isn't so intense, I guess. But I went out there years back with some friends, a couple friends, a friend of mine and a friend of his. And he was quite a bit taller than me. I'm 5'2", and I'm all torso. So I hike quite a bit slower than him. And then his friend decided to take some mind-altering substances, which is all right by me, but wound up with them just kind of losing me on the trail, and I had never been in this area before. And I probably would have turned back if I thought that I was going to do the rest of it by myself, just because I hadn't been there before. But I wound up just powering through, hoping I would catch up with them later. I wound up getting up to Inspiration Point and then deciding to head my way back down through this little canyon. And I wound up at one point hearing a roar that I assumed was probably a mountain lion of sorts. So I just started hitting branches against trees and making loud noises myself, hooting and hollering. And then I get to a point where I wound up kind of falling and hitting my head in a way that really scared me. And I was like, oh man, I should probably be dead right now. Because I hit my neck across a tree trunk. And so it was just like, okay, like power through, get somewhere with service, and then you can call somebody. And the lights start going out, so I put my headlamp on. And I'm on this really thin trail with a pretty steep drop on one end and a kind of pipe running through it. And I'm feeling very creeped out, very uneasy, like I'd been watched. I hadn't run across anybody in a while. And just when I was starting to get a little too scared for my own good, I had just a bird kind of hop along in front of me. And this bird guided me through probably a mile of the hike, which was very nice, and it felt very safe and serene. And then as soon as it got all the way dark and my headlamp was on, sorry, this is a little while later, I'm getting a little nervous. My headlamp started to go out and I wound up calling somebody and was like mentioning, hey, like I'm a little scared. I just kind of want to make sure I'm alive and I'm not a ghost and things like that. So my friend wound up driving out to meet me at the trailhead and was waiting for me when I got there. But along the way, I would run into hikers and they didn't have headlamps either. I ran into two and they appeared out of nowhere, but they definitely seeing where they came from and where they went to definitely guided me down the mountain a little bit. So I know that wasn't necessarily haunting or anything, but it's just there was a lot of weird instances and feelings that got me through it. So yeah. But it is a special and interesting forest. I would recommend people checking it out, but just know what you're getting into first. Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Cassie. No need to be nervous. Unless, of course, you find yourself back on that trail. You know, when I first moved to LA 17 years ago, I did a hike through the Haunted Forest. Only I didn't know it was called the Haunted Forest back then. It was just a hiking trail to us. But me and a couple of friends spent the better part of a day exploring around that area. And I'll be honest, it felt weird back then. It had an odd energy, I guess you could say. Then I returned to do a hike to Echo Mountain, which is next to Inspiration Point, Cassie's destination in the story. This hike occurred probably around 2015. Sarah and a couple of other good friends joined me on that outing. And wouldn't you know, the area felt even more strange that time. The vibe was just off. Lots of fog on the trail. It was raining over some portions of the hike, but sunny and bright over others. Ruins of stone and steel seemed to be littered everywhere, broken and twisted among the brush. And the entire time we were there, I had the distinct feeling that we were being observed in some way, like someone was specifically watching us, though we passed dozens of other people over the course of the afternoon. But somehow I did not know this area was also known as the Haunted Forest. I just learned that fact a few years ago when we last covered this odd area. But the name is fitting, because that piece of land has some interesting history that's helped to build that reputation. For a bird's eye look, we send it to Desmond Shaw in the air over Altadena's Haunted Forest.
This is the Cobb Estate, also widely known as the Haunted Forest. Now, we'll get to that haunted part in a bit, but what's now a popular hiking trail was once the site of a failed gold mine before becoming a sprawling estate built by Seattle timber tycoon Charles Cobb. In 1917, he built a mansion on over 100 acres of land here to escape the harsh winters of the Northwest before relocating here permanently. According to the Altadena Historic Society, Cobb was a very high-ranking local Freemason, so when he passed away in 1939, the property was inherited by Pasadena Freemasons, who used it as a Masonic retirement home. Then, in 1956, the property was actually bought by the Marx Brothers, Groucho, Harpo, and Gummo. By this time, the property had really fallen into serious disrepair. The Marx Brothers had the mansion and all the outbuildings demolished. Not much remains from those days. It was around this time that the property began to develop a haunted reputation by locals who said that they could hear weird sounds at night and told stories of eerie lights all around the property, though it's likely what they saw and heard were the many vandals and squatters who would frequent the property after sundown. down. The Marx Brothers didn't do any favors to dispel that haunted reputation, though, because they wanted to rezone this land and build a cemetery here. But neighbors were not hearing, were not having any of that, and so the Marx Brothers backed off of that idea. When the land went up for auction in 1971, it was nearly bought by developers, but a last-second donation by heiress and philanthropist Virginia Steele Scott allowed the city to buy the land to preserve as open space. So now this is a popular gateway to Echo Mountain and the abandoned Mount Low Railway, which is a whole other story that only adds to the haunted reputation of the area. There's also some spooky tunnels left over from the gold mining days scattered about the trails. Some websites claim that this is one of the most haunted places in Southern California.
Now that clip from KCAL in Los Angeles. So I get it, Cassie. I understand why things might have felt a little bit strange up there. There's certainly enough history to support it. But you know, I've also since learned of another detail about this area. Apparently, the city's homeless have found shelter in the hills above the Cobb Estate. Or at least did at certain points over the last few decades. So could that have caused some of the strange activity that Cassie had reported? And did I have those feelings of being watched because I was indeed being watched? Or is it that the legends of the Cobb Estate and the Haunted Forest are 100% true? If you find yourself hiking there, look out for floating blue orbs, strange men in long dark robes, the spectral spirit of a nun that was murdered years ago, or a witch-like entity said to roam around the ruins. And something one witness referred to as a floating black mass. And if you do encounter any or all of that, be sure to let us know. And thank you again, Cassie, for calling in. Hey guys, I have something fun to announce. David Flora and myself were lucky enough to be featured on the History Channel program, Beyond Skinwalker Ranch. Now, the episode just aired on Tuesday, and I believe you can find it wherever you can find that series. It was a ton of fun and a little bit spooky to share the Borrego Triangle with the guys from the program. And although I have yet to see the episode, I'm certainly looking forward to it. And I hope you are as well. Now, if you will, let's do a little exercise to better get you aligned with nature. Close your eyes, unless you're driving or working or running security. You know what, keep your eyes open. But imagine yourself in a far-off place, a desolate valley in the great American Southwest. But thanks to the blue hue of the moon, you can make out each and every shrub, rock, and tree laid out before you. You've pitched your tent, built a sensible fire. You have prepared and eaten your meal. So you kick back to feel the fire's warmth, to hear the sounds of nature envelop you. Then you hear it, a noise that shatters the peace and sends needles into your nerves. Nick from Idaho has had just such an experience.
Hey Derek, this is Nick. I'm a third time repeat offender for Monsters Among Us, and I got a story from you. I'm from Idaho, but this story is from Canyonlands National Park Needles District. It's a southern division of Canyonlands in Utah. Me and a few buddies, we go down to the Southwest and go camp out for about 2 weeks and just kind of hop from place to place, you know, Bryce, Zion, Escalante, Canyonlands, you know, Arches, Capitol Reef. We just kind of bounce around, but in this occasion, we were at, the Canyonlands National Park, Needles District. We were in the campground, but we picked one of the branches off on the right-hand side, and we ended up getting this one little isolated campsite, and there was nobody else around, and it was kind of all on its own, you know, cut off from the rest of the campground for a national park campground. I mean, that was as good as it gets. So we set up camp. You know, me and a buddy, we slept in this big, huge, like, cabin tent that I brought. And then my buddy Billy was in a small backpacking tent, you know, about 20 feet from us. And this one night we were having a few drinks and just kind of, you know, taking it easy from driving the previous night. And we settled down and went to bed and just about to fall asleep and heard something kind of approaching camp. And it was the most weird sound I've ever heard in my life. And I'm an outdoor guy. I spend a lot of my time outside camping all over the West, and I've never heard anything like this. So this sound, it was just kind of a repeating sound as it was kind of traversing towards our camp. And the best way I can describe this sound was an inhale whistle, like a human whistle, followed by a deep guttural, I mean, really bassy, huge lung cavity, you know, growl. And it kind of went... It was freaking weird. And I mean, it sent chills up my spine. And I kind of whispered to my buddies. I was like, Billy, you hear that? And Billy's like, yes, I'm sitting up in my tent with my knife. And we just sat there and listened to this thing. And like maybe every 5-10 seconds, it would repeat the same whistle followed by the same growl. And it kind of cut as a diagonal and traversed kind of almost through our camp, but maybe about 20 yards off onto the rock bluff that was kind of behind our campsite. And it passed, you know, kind of in close proximity, and then just kind of carried on. And I mean, it was so confusing because it was like the whistle from a bird, or, you know, a human inhale whistle. You know, you got that really high pitch followed by something that was like way below, you know, human vocal range and really, really deep, almost, I don't know. It was really strange. You know, I even wrote the National Park Service asking them, you know, what the hell is that? What the hell was that? Any ideas? Like a cougar? Or, because I know cougars can whistle, but they kind of sound more like a chirp. And I haven't heard anything like that. Something to consider if anybody has any ideas is, I mean, it would have to have big lung capacity. Whatever this thing was, it was really big. I mean, bigger than a human, but it has to have the capability to create a whistle that is, yeah, equivalent to the one where I was just kind of mimicking it. Yeah, any ideas? I'm open to options, but as for now, I've never heard anything like it. So, you know, we're kind of down there in the Southwest, and everybody knows kind of the weird shit that happens down there. So, yeah, let me know what you think. And love the podcast, of course, and thank you very much, Derek.
Thank you, Nick. You know, I thought it was pretty clever here. I immediately suspected it might have been a bighorn ram making the sounds. So I set out to find a sound clip to demonstrate that point. Tons of Google searching, and a couple of hours later, I began to come to the realization that bighorn ram probably do not make these sounds. So there goes that theory. So now, like Nick, I am stumped. But if anyone out there tuning in has an idea of what might have made this sound, what animal, or possibly creature, inhabits that area and has the potential to make a sound like what Nick described? Well, if you have an idea, we're certainly all ears. So give us a call and fill us in. And until then, thank you again, Nick, for the phone call. Well, folks, let's set a new scene here. The heart of Appalachia. A lake, a tent, a man, a woman, and something in the darkness. This is exactly how horror movies start. Now, before I push play, I will warn you, this call is a little longer than I'd like it to be, but I promise you it is worth it. And I promise it will leave you wanting more. So, Kat from Colorado, welcome to the program.
Hi, Derek. This is Kat, and I'm calling from Colorado. This story actually takes place in West Virginia, close to Morgantown, West Virginia, when I was in college, way back in the 80s, so pretty long time ago. A friend of mine and I, a close friend, decided that we were going to take a little overnight camping trip up into the Cooper's Rock Reservoir area right outside of Morgantown. Now, this place had some legends attached to it, some ghostly sightings, and the thing everybody used to say was that there were druids up there that did rituals or Satan groups and things like that, and that it was haunted. I had some friends that said they spotted UFOs up there. So, you know, although we loved those kind of stories and those kind of things, you know, intrigued us, that's not why we went. We went up just to really go into the backcountry, take a night off, camp out underneath the stars near the water, and then come back fresh for midterms or whatever we were doing. So we borrowed his roommate's car, and we loaded it with tents and camping stuff and some snacks and an inflatable raft, and we drove up to the reservoir. And we drove off the beaten path and got onto this dirt road, and my friend, he really wanted to go back into, way back up into the country, into the backwoods. And that was the plan, was to get as far away as we possibly could alone. So we went until the road stopped and we were still around the reservoir. And then we hiked in and then we inflated the raft and we got in the raft, threw everything in the raft and like paddled even further up into the reservoir until we found a little inlet that we thought was pretty cool. And we decided we were going to spend the night there. We set up a tent. There was nobody around anywhere. This was about as isolated as you could get, with a beautiful reservoir, trees, forest right there. There wasn't any beaches or anything around where we were. It was just this little like inlet with some outcroppings, and then we put our tent in there. Now my friend, he tied up the raft with the paddles maybe 10 feet from where our tent was, and he tied it to a tree. Tied the ropes and everything to the tree and put the paddles inside the boat. And the boat was not in the water. It was on land tied to the tree. So very important point later on about this. So, you know, we're having a great afternoon. We had some snacks. At some point, we decided to smoke a little bit of pot. Now, we weren't druggies. That's not why we went up there. I was never one to do a lot of anything in college. But we did, I think, just had a joint with us, I think, and so we smoked a little bit and relaxed, and I think he was going to put some hot dogs on a little grill, and so I went and was sitting by the water on a rock, just watching the water. Now, it was really quiet out there, and I started to overthink things, and as the afternoon wore on, I was thinking, wow, what if, I started to imagine these scenarios that, like, what if, you know, while we were here, you know, the world ended out there and we were here by ourselves. And what if when we went back to civilization, nobody was there? And then we started talking like that, you know, whether it was the little bit of pot that we smoked or whatever. But we had this really fun conversation. One of our favorite books that we had read during that time was Stephen King's The Stand. And so we were always talking about, you know, the plague and Captain Trips and everything else. So the evening went on, and like I said, we didn't smoke any more pot after that. We just ate some hot dogs or whatever, and we, you know, talking. We was getting dark, and we started a fire. And as the evening wore on, it started to get windy, and it was very dark. And we were kind of in the forested area, and you have to imagine the trees that are in there are huge, tall trees. And this was in the end of September, beginning of October, I think. So it was getting chilly, and there were still leaves on the trees, but it was fall-ish. And as the wind grew, it started to get colder. And not only that, but the wind started to just howl. We could hear it coming down the coastline of the reservoir and around the whole cove that we were in. And it just started to howl around us, to the point where suddenly we start, at least how this started was, I started to hear what sounded like screaming in the trees. And I wasn't sure at first whether he was hearing it or not. And there were these, it was like this whooping, screaming, like female voices cackling way up in the trees, like with the wind just howling and whipping around everywhere. And at one point there was this wicked laughter way up in the wind in the trees, and I startled, and at the same time my friend startled, and I was like, "You're hearing that, right?" And he's like, "Yeah, I hear that." And I'm like, "God, it just sounds like people screaming and laughing up there." I mean, never in my life had I ever heard anything like that. And, you know, I'm an avid outdoors person, always have been. We had no qualms about going out into the wilderness, etc. So it really kind of freaked us out that we were hearing that. So we decided we were letting our imaginations get carried away with us. And we sat around this little fire for a little bit longer. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, and I mean out of nowhere, both of us had the exact same reaction to something. And what it was we thought something was coming up behind us. And for whatever reason, both of us like turned, startled, and like looked the same way as if something was like running up behind us. And the wind is still whipping and howling and everything. And we look at each other and we're like, "Man, I've had enough of this. Let's just get some sleep, you know. Let's go to bed, blah, blah, blah. And then in the morning, you know, we'll paddle down and we'll laugh about this or whatever." We were just getting too scared. So we got inside the tent, and it was one of those old-fashioned tents that had the pole in the middle. And we fought with it for a good hour with the wind whipping around us and everything else. And the wind was just unbelievable. Until I drifted off to sleep. Several hours later, I wake up and my friend isn't there. He's not in the tent with me. And I was like, "What the hell?" So I'm laying there, and it's got to be about 4:30 in the morning. And suddenly he comes flying in the tent. I mean, like if he dove into the tent and grabbed me and said, "Get up, we're leaving." And I was like, "What? What? What?" He said, get up. Come on, we're leaving right now. Get up, we're leaving." And I get up, and he's like, just do what I say. And so I grab everything I could, grab the tent. He's like, "Don't worry about anything. We're just going to throw it in the boat. And he threw everything in the boat. The boat is right there near the water. And so he says, get in there. He like throws me in this boat, this raft. And this guy, and you have to understand, the water is freezing cold, right? He jumps in the water, and he pushes me out with all of the crap in it, like as far as he can go, like as fast and as far and as hard as he can go, until the water is up to his chest. And he jumps in the raft, and he grabs a paddle, and he starts paddling toward the middle of the reservoir. And I'm still like, "What the hell? What's going on? Tell me what's going on." And he wouldn't say anything. He's like, just be quiet. And I'm like, "What happened to the other paddle?" He only had one paddle. And he's like, never mind. So he paddles out to the middle of the reservoir, and it's just getting light out. So I can just see the shore, and I can just see, you know, the water and everything. And I'm still asking him, "God, what's the matter? What happened? Well, I'm scared to death. You're really scaring me. What's happening?" And he says, "I'll tell you when we get out of here." And so I sat in the boat while he paddled down, and he stayed in the middle of that reservoir, and he's scanning the shoreline the whole time, and he's looking up and down the shoreline. And we get to the place where we got into the water to begin with the day before, and he dragged everything out. He just shoved everything in the car. The car was still there, and he's, get in. And he gets in the car, and he drives like a bat out of hell down this road, this like dirt road, you know, from 10 miles. And I'm like, "What happened? You have to tell me what happened." So finally, I'm freaked out. Finally, he stops the car and he says, "Okay, I'll tell you what happened." He said, "So you fell asleep, and about 30 minutes after that, I heard something weird outside the tent, and I got up to check everything." And he said, "The boat was gone. The boat was not on the tree. The paddles were gone." And so he thought maybe it had come loose and it had blown away. So he went and walked up the shoreline and was walking and looking to see if he could find the boat. And he did. He found it. He found it about 100 yards away, tied to a tree. Not only tied to a tree, but strapped to a tree. Someone had tied it to a tree. He only could find one paddle, so he untied it, and he said he saw something. And honest to God, to this day, I don't know, Derek, what he saw. He never told me what he saw, but he said it scared him enough so that all he could think about was getting me out of there and getting me back to safety. To this day, I have no idea what he saw or what happened that night or what scared him so much to get me out of there like that. His roommate, also, who was a good friend of mine, told me for years, said he never told him what had happened, but he said he saw something that scared him to death and that he would never, ever, ever, ever go back up there again, but he wouldn't talk about it. That's my story. I hope you liked it. Have a good night. Thanks for your show. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Kat. That's actually a different Kat from earlier in the show. We had two Kats this evening. And what a story. My imagination is running overtime, going through the gambit of suspects, crazed mountain folks, Sasquatch, maybe a feral human, maybe some sort of swamp man. And given the fact that we're in West Virginia, maybe it's the Mothman. Or perhaps the guy just freaked himself out and made up the whole story about the missing boat as an excuse to head home for the night. Fear will make you do some squirmy things. And I myself have been caught in a windstorm in a tent. So I get it. It is pretty scary. But is it scary enough to send a man chest deep into icy cold waters in the middle of the night? Something tells me no. You know, it sounds like to me that Kat's friend saw something that evening. And what that thing is only limited by our imagination. And given the location, I feel like it has the potential to be quite literally anything. Not only Appalachia, but West Virginia, as well, is known for harboring all sorts of strange lore and legend. Now, I tried to dig up some stories from that area that might help explain what the duo encountered that night, but I didn't have a single hit. Which I suppose shouldn't surprise anyone, because folks stay pretty tight-lipped around those parts. At least about stuff like that. So I'll leave this one like we leave so many, as a mystery. But we do thank you again, Kate, for sharing it with us. I know it's a tale that I'll be thinking of next time I find myself in a tent late at night. And that's all there is, folks. The Summerween Spooktacular, covering the great outdoors. I had a great time sharing these calls with you, and the fun doesn't have to end here. You can meet me after the intro for more Monsters Among Us. And there you can get info on how you can keep the outdoor calls rolling here this evening. But first, Monsters Among Us is written and produced by me, Derek Hayes. Copyright Red Crow Media. Additional support is provided by Sarah Carter Hayes and Delaney Bowers. All media used in this production is done so under the protection of fair use. Please do me a huge favor and take the time to leave us a rate and review over at Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever they take reviews. You could not imagine how beneficial it is to have those good reviews. So if you've left one in the past, a good one at least, we thank you. And while you're surfing the web, be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And don't forget to visit unxnetwork.com to hear the show every Saturday night at 11 p.m. on digital radio. It'd be a cool way to experience the show. And lastly, tonight's score was provided by Iron Cthulhu Apocalypse. co.agmusic, and Carl Casey at White Bat Audio. And there you have it. If you find yourself outside listening to this episode, I am sorry. If you're not, go get yourself outdoors and experience some of the strange activity yourself. Maybe I'll even see you out there. Until then, keep it spooky, and have yourselves a great night.
And discounts.
Walking this path together.
Too many dimensions.
Oro Radio Lasse.
At school and online.
I have one more call to share with you this evening. You see, one of my favorite summer pastimes is fishing. I don't get to do it as often as I once did, and I'm not nearly as good as I once was, but I enjoy it nonetheless. So I thought it fitting to end on a story about a whopper that got away. So from here in my state of California, please welcome Joe to tonight's program.
Hey, Derek, this is Joe from Sacramento. I love the show. I'll admit I'm a bit of a skeptic, but I love listening. And what I'm about to call, I can understand. There's a little tidbit for people who truly believe. You know, I want to believe. But for a moment, I can understand the view of people who think they're seeing something. So I was fishing off the Freeport Bridge, people in Sacramento will know, off the Sacramento River. Just kind of getting used to it. I just moved up here. And fishing, not a whole lot going on. It's middle of the day, very hot out. It's not ideal fishing time. But I just cast. I'm about 300 feet south of the bridge. And I see this huge boil. So big, I thought, did someone jump off the bridge? To the point where I thought maybe someone was swimming out there because I saw what looked like an arm, like a silver arm, come up and then down. I thought, that's not someone swimming. I would have seen someone jump. I thought, what on earth is that? That's crazy. I wish I had cast a little bit closer to that. All of a sudden, a few seconds later, 100 feet down the river, boom, same thing. I'm thinking, I'm losing my mind. Sure enough, 200 feet. Boom, same thing. And until the river bends, I could see it bend the river. Absolutely crazy. And for context, right after that, I see a cormorant, a very large swimming aquatic bird that does a very similar thing, right? It'll dive, up, maybe 5-10 feet between dives. Not even close. And then right after that, maybe about an hour, I see a seal. The Sacramento River does go into San Pablo Bay, into the ocean, so you do get seals and sea lions, and again, not even close. Very obvious that it was breathing when it came up, the seal. Much shorter intervals, not 100 feet, and much smaller. Very obvious it was a seal or a sea lion. This was something totally different. Huge. I mean, it sounds like a fishing story from a guy that didn't catch anything that day, but I've grown up my whole life, freshwater, saltwater fishing, the biggest boil. For those who don't fish, a boil is when the fish will strike the top of the water. Usually they get something. Biggest boil I've ever seen. Not even close. Wasn't drinking. Just chilling. Not doing anything. Now, I did Google. There are huge sturgeon in the river. They've caught 7 to 8 foot sturgeon. If you look at videos, that's a sea monster. That's a river monster if anyone's ever seen one. But for those who want to believe a little bit more, if you do Google, there are some deep tracks. It's not a lot. You'll see in a couple internet searches, a couple books, river monsters, serpent monsters located in the Sacramento River. And if you want to give it a little bit of a stretch, a little bit earlier in the 1900s, you have in the Trinity Alps, which is about northeast, actually, of Sacramento, you will have in the Trinity Alps location reports of giant salamanders, big ones. So, again, personally, a little bit more on the skeptical side. Probably sturgeon, maybe the largest sea lion I've ever seen, but for a moment, losing my mind. absolutely going crazy, going, am I going nuts watching this? So love the show. Do great work. Just a fun little moment. And again, for a second, even as a skeptic, you know, a skeptic who loves the show, I got to really tune into the feeling of someone going, am I losing it? What am I seeing out of here? So thanks so much. Keep it up.
Thank you, Joe. A good old-fashioned river monster story. How very Jaws-esque of Joe. Now let's break down all the possibilities here. My first thought was also a sturgeon. These things get huge, so it's certainly the right size. But that's not typical sturgeon behavior. They're typically on the bottom, scavenging, not on the surface, feeding. And I thought of a few other ideas, but outside of the sturgeon theory, I didn't have much to go on. So whenever I run across a story about something strange in our waters, I know exactly where to turn for help. Friend of the show and star of The Proof is Out There on the History Channel, Dr. Shay Steingass, a biologist that works out of the Pacific Northwest and knows of all things in the water. Now, she's always good for a unique perspective, so I sent her Joe's call. And what she proposed to me is not paranormal per se, but it is a bit terrifying. You see, Joe described seeing a boil on the surface of the water. Now, a boil is essentially just disturbed water on the surface, typically caused by bait fish, small fish that school in a tight ball as a defense mechanism. And that's where the quote-unquote boiling effect comes from. Those fish undulating on the surface. And of course, the predators that are feeding on them. The seal, the cormorant, and the creature that Joe witnessed. But according to Dr. Steingass, the dead giveaway here was the quote-unquote silver arm. A giveaway I'm embarrassed that I didn't think of myself. Because you see, there's a particular shark that lives off the coast of California, called the thresher shark. And what is unique about this shark is that the vertical part of its tail extends 3 or 4 times longer than that of most other sharks, giving it an exaggeratedly tall tail fin. And get this, it uses that tail fin to smack these bait balls, stunning fish long enough for it to circle back and gobble them up. So in short, Dr. Steingass suggested to me that it was a thresher shark that somehow swam upstream in hot pursuit of these bait fish, the fish that caused the disturbance Joe witnessed, lured in just like the seal and the cormorant were. The silver, quote-unquote, arm that Joe saw could have been that tail being flung toward those bait fish at top speeds. Now I bet you're asking yourself the same question I asked Dr. Steingass. Do these sharks normally swim into freshwater habitats? And perhaps you'll be as surprised as I was to learn that sometimes, yes, they do. Do you want some proof? Here's an incident I found that took place on the East Coast but involves the same species. This encounter occurred back in May of 2017, and this report is property of WPVI, ABC News 6, out of Philadelphia.
A shark was spotted in the Indian River Inlet this week in Delaware. A crew from the Delaware Center for Inland Bays spotted the thresher shark yesterday afternoon. A spokesperson there says it is unusual but not unheard of for that type of shark to be that close to shore. Officials believe this shark probably followed a school of fish into the area. It was eventually led back deeper into the ocean. Thresher sharks are not considered dangerous to humans due to their timid nature and small teeth.
Now, to add to the pile of evidence, the bridge Joe was fishing from is not that far from San Pablo Bay, as Joe had alluded to. As the crow flies, it's less than 50 miles. And according to Dr. Steingass, some other species like seals can be found 200 or 300 miles upstream. So I suppose all the pieces are falling into place. But before you sign this off as a simple shark sighting, allow me to leave you with this tidbit of information. Joe is right. Since the late 1800s, folks around the Sacramento River have been reporting a strange creature in the waters. Sightings in 1891, 1939, and 1999. help to give those claims clout. All three describing a massive salamander-like creature with four legs and a long tail. And if Reddit poster Diligent Tower 658 story is to be believed, it was witnessed just 6 months ago. That creature's description is as follows, pulled directly from the report posted on the cryptid subreddit. It was a teal-colored, scaly, reptilian beast that was large, about the size of a large cow, but it was swimming in a manner similar to a seal or a sea lion. It had a robust body with four fins, a large pair on the front area and smaller ones on the back area instead of legs, and a short tail without any fins. Its skull was short yet massive, filled with blunt teeth that looked like it could crush bones, and it had yellow reptilian eyes, which appeared to glow when I shine my flashlight at it. So maybe there is something out there, after all. Something sinking beneath the surface, just waiting for the right meal to cross its path. Keep that in mind as you're dipping your toes in the water this summer. Anything could be down there. Thank you again, Joe, for stopping by, and a huge thanks to everyone else for tuning in this evening. This doesn't have to be goodbye, though. You can stick around for the Beyond portion of the show, where I have several more outdoor-themed calls primed and ready to load. So join us, won't you? Visit patreon.com and search for Monsters Among Us podcast, or click the Patreon tab on our website. Sign up, join the $5 level, then boom, you're an instant listener. And remember, you can do it all for free for 7 full days, so you have no excuses. I sure hope to see you over there in the Beyond, where we share calls like Fisher's out of the state of Colorado.
Hey, Derek, my name is Fisher. I live in Salida, Colorado. It's a rural town in the high mountains. I have a call that might pertain to a phenomenon known as the not deer. I know you're not supposed to say their name, but I did, so what you gonna do about it? This happened over...